You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to archpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to archpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Welcome to Heritage Voices. This is episode 8, and today we are talking to Anna Cordova on Indigenous archaeology, ethnography, and tribal consultation at a state and local level. So Anna Cordova is lead archaeologist with the City of Colorado Springs, the city's first archaeologist. She is a Colorado Springs native and graduate of University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. She has been conducting professional archaeology for over 12 years. She has archaeological experience in several states, with most of her experience in Colorado and Hawaii. Her focus throughout her career has been on Indigenous involvement in the field of archaeology, where she concentrates on tribal and Native community consultations, repatriation issues, and general communication with Indigenous people about the various archaeological sites she has been a part of. Her main career goal is to help bridge the gap between archaeologists and Indigenous people while working to decolonize archaeology. So welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you. So first I should say that while I am the lead archaeologist for the City of Colorado Springs Parks and Rec, I am not speaking on behalf of the city at this time. So just got to get that out of the way.
All right. So I think we'll just get started the way I usually get started, which is okay. With asking, how did you get interested in all of this in the first place?
That is a good question. Well, I always tell people that from the time I was about 6 or 7 years old, I remember being introduced to history in elementary school and just eating it up. I just loved every part of it. I think it kind of started with the Revolutionary War time period and things like that, where I loved it. Even as a 6 and 7 year old child, I think some of that also grew from just sitting around listening to my grandparents tell stories about their parents. And I've just always had this fundamental passion about learning about the past and about people who came before us. And so it's always fascinated me. So once I got into high school, everybody kept telling me I should be a historian. I was a big nerd, always looking back at, you know, different events in history and really just studying them outside of school and things like that. And I knew that I wanted to do something along those lines, but being a historian sounded like a lot of indoor time and a lot of sitting behind a desk. So my mom actually told me that she had wanted to be an archaeologist when she had first graduated from college, but she didn't have the opportunity to go to college. And that kind of put that bug in my head. And I, ever since then, I was probably about 17 at that time. So once I got to college, I took anthropology right away, the first two introduction to anthropology classes. And then that very next semester as a freshman, I was taking 3000 level, junior level classes in archaeology. I just knew what I wanted to do and I went for it.
That's awesome. So, okay. So how did you, from going to first being interested in history and then learning about archaeology and wanting to do archaeology, how did you then discover that you wanted to do Indigenous and decolonized archaeology?
Let's see. I think just being in an academic setting, I had been raised in kind of a very white environment as a child, very religious environment, and listening to so my mother is Irish, my dad is the native side. So once I told my grandparents what I wanted to do, my native grandparents, what I wanted to do with my career, they were kind of like, you want to do what? You know what, you know what right, anthropologists right. do and what they, you know, what they've done in the past, and you know what archaeology is.
Right.
And, you know, there's definitely taboos about, you know, dealing with people in the past and touching artifacts and things like that. So I think that kind of spurred some of my questioning about who should be involved in archaeology from that perspective, I suppose. But then once I got into college and I was one of the only brown faces in any room I was in, yet what kind of, whose history were they talking about? They were talking about, you know, a lot right. of my ancestors' history, and there was nobody representing my cultural groups talking about it. So it was striking to me, I guess, from the very beginning to look at the fact that non-Indigenous people are largely considered the authorities on Indigenous past.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothered me even from, you know, 18, 19 years old. It was really the only, it was really the first time that I had really thought about it. It still bothers me today right. when you go to any large conference or any large archaeological meeting. I am nearly always one of the only non-white people in the room. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about, generally, we're not talking about Euro-Americans. We're talking about Indigenous people. So
mm-hmm.
That definitely has spurred a lot of that, those, you know, the questions of why do my grandparents have a problem with archaeologists? What are they doing that has hurt Indigenous people, that has kind of broken down a lot of the trust between them?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, of course, it doesn't take a whole lot of study into archaeology to really look at how colonistic archaeology really is, how imperialistic the study
right,
is,
right, right.
has been from the very beginning, and still is in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that just really fortified my thoughts that we need more Indigenous people involved in archaeology and interpreting our ancestors' past. And I don't ever feel like that necessarily needs to be me. I feel like I can kind of, in some ways, serve as that bridge in some ways, but I wasn't raised in the traditional sense, so I don't feel like I have authority on a lot of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like definitely we need, as archaeologists, we need to bring in Indigenous people who do know that past, who are authorities on these things. And a lot of times I think that's greatly neglected in archaeology. It's a huge resource, not just for archaeologists, but also for Indigenous people. I think it can be a powerful tool. And I think that's what drew me to it.
Mm-hmm. So, and only if you feel comfortable talking about this, but could you maybe talk a little bit more about what that was like negotiating with your grandparents' reaction, for example, on the taboos against archaeology and wanting to become an archaeologist, and if their understanding of archaeology has shifted at all with having you be an archaeologist, or if that's something that you still struggle with?
I don't think that my grandparents had real strong feelings about it. I think they questioned it at the beginning because I think it was just something completely unfamiliar to them to think, why do you want to get involved in that? It was kind of this idea that we know our past. So why do we want to, you know, where is this desire coming from that you need to get more into it? You know, we have our stories, we know our traditions, we know our history. So why do we need, I guess, non-Native people and non-Native scientists coming in and not only contradicting, but why do we need that?
Mm-hmm.
Why do, you know, we don't need any backup. So
right.
I think it was more those ideas. And then my grandparents have both since passed away, but I think it was once I got more into it and understood more of it myself. And I think at the beginning, I didn't know why I was so interested in it either. I'm not even sure now where that passion comes from, but I came from originally. But now knowing what kind of tools we can have, I mean, being able to interpret and present your own past is a powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once my grandparents kind of understood that, I don't think they had a real problem with it from the beginning. I think it was more just, why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess another part that you started to touch on there is that there's still that predominantly anthropologists, archaeologists are still non-Indigenous people looking at Indigenous culture. And how can we try to bring in more Indigenous people into this field?
Yeah, I get asked that quite a bit. And it's kind of a tough question. I think it depends on the group that you're looking at. I think it's the way in that you present it. Again, I think maybe, and these are various cultures and everything, so I don't want to paint it with a broad brush. But I do feel like sometimes it is looked at that's not a profession that's even known, I guess, that it's something that you can go into. I think a lot of people look at it the same way that my grandparents did. Why?
Right.
You know, we know our history and we know our past. So I think going in and telling youth is in particular the benefits of it, or tribal members and tribal leaders, the benefits of really getting involved, which I don't think necessarily needs to be emphasized so much at this point. I think a lot of our tribal leaders and people understand the value of it. But I think that it is important for us to get to the youth, to the younger people, to tell them this is an option. This is why it's important. This can be an empowering tool. This can be a tool against colonialism. We can tell our own history and our own past, and we can create more pride in our culture and ourselves by telling our own past and creating our own museums and taking control of telling our ancestors' stories.
One more thing that I noticed when I was looking through your CV that I thought was really interesting, and I'd like to make sure that we get to it, is that your master's is in applied geography and environmental studies with an emphasis on archaeology and Indigenous geographies.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about this Indigenous geographies component and what made you interested in that aspect, and just more about what that program was like?
Sure. So right after I got my bachelor's degree, about a year later, I got a position in Hawaii where I was doing mostly cultural impact assessments. So I was doing very little actual archaeology, but in the state of Hawaii, there are laws that say for any project involving state or federal funds, you need to do an environmental impact statement, which generally always will involve a cultural impact assessment. So a cultural impact assessment, the purpose of an environmental impact assessment is to ask mainly Native Hawaiians in Hawaii about traditional cultural properties and practices, past, present, and ongoing, which was exactly what I wanted to be doing. It was tribal consultation, which is obviously different in Hawaii because there's no tribal kind of system set up. So it was just contacting community members. So I fell in love with that. But a lot of the projects that I was involved in, I was working on Maui, where, you know, for every project, a lot of times you're contacting the same families and the same leaders over and over again. But that idea of a sense of place, that the Indigenous geographies, not only the place names and the way that we think about the land and the ways that we're connected to the land versus non-Indigenous ways. So obviously coming from the mainland, I saw a lot of similarities between Native Hawaiians and other Indigenous people. And so I think the strongest thread there was definitely that connection to the land, that I don't want to be cheesy, but you know, we are genuinely kin with the land. It's not something that we're dominating over. We're part of it. And so what's done to it is done to us, and vice versa. So that got me really interested in that. So when I went to write my master's thesis, I would have preferred actually to do my master's program in anthropology. It just happened that this was the place that I needed to go for different reasons. But it actually worked out quite well. I got to work with the anthropology department, but also with geography, it really helped me hone in that idea of that sense of place where I was looking at that through cultural impact assessments and how these places, what they not only mean to Indigenous people, but how that meaning can help with certain projects. For example, the telescope on Mauna Kea, the 30-meter telescope that had all that international attention and things like that. I looked at that in my master's thesis, talking about not only how the telescope project is impacting Indigenous people and their connection to that place, but how we can use that for non-Indigenous people to treat the land and to treat projects like this. I think if we had, if people had that connection, and I think at certain points throughout history, everybody has had those connections to those places where they're native to. I think if everybody had that sense of belonging to the land and to that place and that kinship with that place, I think it would solve a whole lot of our issues in the world. I think it would help us to think about things differently, not only the animals that a lot of these big projects are impacting and the archaeology that we're impacting and things like that, but it will help us to save it for future generations. A lot of the Indigenous groups that I've worked with too have also talked about, you know, to the seventh generation, thinking ahead to that seventh generation. And I think that has to do very much with that connection to place. What you do to that place will affect your generations later on. So I think that's where I kind of got that desire to look into that and to look into, I was really looking at the effectiveness of cultural impact assessments, just like we saw with the Dakota Access Pipeline. And we see over and over and over again with tribal consultation that's required through Section 106 and other processes, people oftentimes do those. They check the box saying done. Okay, we did it.
Right.
We were required to. The law tells us we had to do it. So we check that box off. Here's the letter saying that we did it. This is what they said. Now let's move on and do whatever we want, because very few laws actually say, okay, but you have to listen to them.
Right.
And Hawaii is one of the only exceptions I've ever seen. And even there, I feel like a lot of the times, if the cultural impact assessment says, yes, there will be significant adverse impacts to cultural traditions and practices and resources on this through this project, then you have to do this and this and this. Whereas with a lot of the Section 106 stuff, I don't see any of those stipulations where it just says you have to do the tribal consultation and things, and then you can move on and do whatever you want. At least that's how I've seen it.
Right.
Whereas in Hawaii, not that it's all sunshine and rainbows there, it doesn't work. not that it works every time there, but their state laws do have caveats that say, okay, if this is the finding of significant impact, then it needs to go to this person and this person. But unless there are people who have the funds and the energy and the time to devote to fighting those projects once they get passed through anyway, they get passed through just like any other place. So I actually think that the 30-meter telescope is one example of, it's because Hawaii itself has stricter laws that it seems to have worked for the most part. And still it's in courts being fought. So,
right. Well, I really, really want to ask you more about all of that, but right now we are at our first break point. So we will be back in a moment.
Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
And we are back. So all of that you were just talking about is really interesting, and especially I feel like Hawaii is such an interesting and different case from the other states in a lot of ways. And it looks like we're probably going to have woman from the Hawaii State SHPO on here soon. So I don't want to go too much into Hawaii because we'll go into it with her. But I do want to touch on it a little bit more since it's really interesting. So, okay, you're talking about connection to place in Hawaii. And obviously your experience throughout has mostly been Colorado Springs and then larger Colorado as well and Hawaii. And I'm curious, first of all, like you started to talk about some of the differences and similarities between Hawaii and Colorado as an example of one of the mainland states. And then B, obviously Colorado has special significance to you since you've worked in Colorado for so long. So do you feel that kind of connection to place, like you were talking about with Hawaii, with the Colorado Springs area?
I do. My family is originally from New Mexico, at least on my father's side, but has been in Colorado for many, many generations since. And I'm sure we're coming up here for thousands of years. So I definitely have that connection here. I know that my umbilical cord is buried in southern Colorado. So what drew me to Hawaii was that I saw that there was a lot of indigenous influence in the government and in different academics and things like that. So as an undergrad doing some research on indigenous archaeology at the time, this was, you know, 15 years ago or so, there was never any academic articles. There was hardly anything on indigenous people in archaeology or indigenous thoughts on archaeology in any sort of academic setting, except I would find some exceptions where people who were Hawaiian or Polynesian were writing about that kind of thing. So that kind of sparked that desire. And then once I graduated and the job opportunity came up, I applied for it. And I let them know, of course, that was one of my interests, was looking at that indigenous involvement in archaeology, not only from indigenous archaeologists, but from participants in the community. So I wanted to go there and do that. But then again, I found a lot of connections with the place. I always knew that I am not from Hawaii. It's interesting. It's an interesting feeling to go to Hawaii. And my dad, when he would visit, felt the same way. It feels a little intrusive, I feel like, to go to Hawaii. It's been so exploited by non-Indigenous people. And it's so overused, and there's so many tourists, and you go there and it's like any other reservation type of setting where who are the poor people in the area? It's the Indigenous people who've totally been taken advantage of. It feels a little strange to live there and to be there, knowing that you don't necessarily belong there. I felt like I was learning while I was there, but I always felt like I needed to bring it home. I needed to come back.
Yeah.
I needed to bring it back to where I'm from. And also I had my two children while I lived in Hawaii. And as they got a little bigger, I moved back when they were 2 and 4. I just, had this feeling that they're not going to know their grandparents. They're not going to know that land. They're not going to know that place. In Hawaii, they also bury the umbilical cord, which I thought was a comforting kind of connection with that culture as well. But I saved my kids because I didn't want them to be buried there. That's not where they belong. That's not where they're from. So I saved them, and they're buried here because this is where we're from. This is where our ancestors are connected, and this is where I am. So definitely that connection is very strong. And especially doing the archaeology here. There's something about looking at certain artifacts and things, thinking maybe it was some of my relatives who were looking at this view at this time while they were sitting here, using this pottery or hunting this buffalo or this deer that connection is definitely very strong, and it's something that I want to emphasize in my own kids. So that was a big part of the reason, even though that was kind of a dream job in Hawaii, I needed to come back here. So here I am.
Yeah, that makes sense. So does it feel, well, I guess you already answered this, but does it You've worked basically with a couple of different types of groups. You've worked in Hawaii with Native Hawaiians. You've worked in Colorado with both Indigenous archaeology and Hispanic archaeology, and then Hispanic archaeology also in Belize, or was that a colonial site?
It was, but it was a Mayan. It was a Mayan site.
Oh, okay.
So it was, yeah, it was a British Mayan. Yeah.
Okay. So how is the experience, does the experience feel different for you working in different places and with different types of groups?
I mean, there are definitely small differences. There's differences just with the connection to that place and those people that have left those artifacts there. But I feel like the similarities are even greater.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that Indigenous way of being and knowing and existing there's a lot of concurrent themes throughout, at least in my experiences. That's how it's been. So I think the similarities are more than the differences.
Right. That makes sense. So, okay. So you had more of an archaeology background, but then you were really interested in bringing Indigenous or descendant community voices into archaeology. Mm-hmm. And so you were doing ethnographic work and tribal consultation.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any specific training in terms of ethnographic tribal consultation type work, or did you really just dive in?
Oh, I definitely just dove in, actually. it was a lot of trial and error, and it can be scary. It can be nerve wracking at times. I definitely have felt like I am Indigenous, but I am in no way an authority. So I feel like I have a little bit of an insider perspective in some ways, anthropologically speaking.
But, right.
I'm definitely still very much an outsider, depending on who I'm talking to as well. So the very first consultation I ever did was on the site that I did my field school when I was 19 years old. So I did that as a 20-year-old student.
Wow.
Having zero training, not really knowing what I was doing, other than I felt like I had a little bit of insight in just talking to other Native people, I guess. So it was kind of funny because the professor who had kind of set it up that wanted me to do it, he had me come, and this was in Colorado Springs, Colorado Springs was putting on an event where they invited a bunch of tribal leaders and people to come and do some presentations at one of our parks. And we were taking advantage of the fact that they were up here to take them to one of our sites where we had done a field school the previous summer.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to meet them the day before at this presentation that they were giving, where there was all kinds of tourists everywhere, but they were giving presentations. And when I went there, the elder that I was talking to right away, you know, my professor was an older white male. And then there's me. And so when I went to go talk to the elder, he immediately started asking me to do things like go get his grandchildren some lemonade. Can you help me carry this? Can you go grab this from my truck? Can you do this? Can you do that? And I didn't question it in any way. I knew what was going on.
He's
doing me a favor. But my professor at the time got a little offended for me and kind of pulled me aside and told me, you know, he's being sexist. He's making you, you know, all these things. Or, you know, he's disrespecting you. And I had to kind of explain to him, no.
Yeah.
He's seeing where I stand.
right.
So I think that was kind of my introduction to it. But it was also pretty nerve-wracking. He definitely, this elder, when we took him to the site, you know, of course I had my list of questions and things for him, but it was more about letting him talk.
Mm-hmm.
And then he definitely asked me quite a few tough questions that made me really think about what I was doing and why I was doing it. And so I think it was a good learning experience for the first time. But yeah, I just totally jumped in head first, not knowing at all what I was doing.
I feel like that happens a lot with ethnographic work and tribal consultation work, where people think you know, oh, with archaeology, you need training, but anybody can talk to somebody. And right. so people just get thrown in, I feel like a lot of times, way over their heads. And, you know, there's mm-hmm. some people that have really been really successful, you know, like it's definitely like sink or swim in that kind of a situation, where some people, you know, because of their background, like for you, or because of their personality or whatever, they can adapt and figure it out quickly enough and do great work that way. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that it's definitely not seen as a skill in the same way that archaeology is.
Right.
So what would you recommend for people who either want to do ethnographic or tribal consultation work, or who, you know, get thrown in because, hey, you're the Native American, you can talk to other Native Americans or whatever. What advice would you give about how to approach this kind of work?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I am an expert in this, but I would say that you need to fully recognize what you're doing and why you're doing it. You need to, I think respect is by far the number one thing that you need to come in with. You need to come in with the idea and the knowledge that these tribal leaders are doing you a favor. They're helping you out. Right. I think a lot of people look at it the opposite way. Oh, look, we're mm-hmm. giving them a chance to comment on the archaeology here. That's not our past as archaeologists. That does not belong to us as archaeologists.
Right.
It's not ours. And I think a lot of people, I think archaeology kind of is almost like a secret club, whereas once you have the training, you can come in there and, you know, you have access to that, to those artifacts and to that knowledge. And, you know, we have to protect it for certain reasons from your average person in order so that it's not exploited. But you kind of get in on this secret club that you're, you know, you're kind of the authority on it and things like that, where... And I think sometimes us as archaeologists go into tribal consultations and things like that with that kind of attitude, that we're the authority on this and that we're kind of giving others a chance to speak on it. We're not. It's not ours. It's not our past. And it's not something to be owned by us. So we need to be respectful and acknowledge the importance of what we're doing. We need to be careful with the information that we're given, and we need to just fully acknowledge the fact that any information that we're given is a privilege to have.
Right.
So I think that's my biggest piece of advice, is to be humble about it, to listen more than you talk. Yeah, I think just number one is just to be respectful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these people know a whole lot more than I ever will know. So I think that's it. Just respect.
Mm-hmm. I really, really like that you started with that you need to really think through what you're doing and why you're there. Because I feel like, I mean, as an ethnographer, at least, you kind of have to be a little bit more face to face with that, because you know, you're directly interacting with people, and what you do with that information has very direct impacts on them that you see.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like a lot of times archaeologists feel like they can somehow get away with not doing that, or not, you know, or believing that the work that they're doing doesn't have an impact on people, just, you know, for example, if you're working with groups that are quote unquote too far back to be affiliated with, that it doesn't still have an impact on living peoples today. And obviously we know that's not true, and it can be very painful for groups looking at an archaeologist doing work with human remains, no matter how old they are, for example. One example.
Right. No,
sorry.
I agree. I feel like, I think archaeologists need to be anthropologists first. We need to understand that there are two different worldviews coming together here when we're doing tribal consultation, and we need to look at it from that way and try to kind of step out of that kind of Western scientific lens to understand how archaeology is impacting living people, to understand how you're interpreting this past and how you do or do not heed the tribal consultation is going to impact that group of people and the descendants of the people that you're studying. And I think a lot of times archaeologists aren't always so great about that. It actually drives me that's something that bothers me the most about archaeology, is this idea that we kind of own the past. I know that that's not a real popular idea now, and I think there's been a lot of turnaround in the last decade or two in regards to that with archaeologists. I think a lot of archaeologists are great and want to work with tribes, but I still feel like a lot of times archaeologists don't contact those tribes unless they need to, unless they're required to by law. And I understand in some ways that we're limited by funding. It takes time and it takes money to do tribal consultation. But I do feel like we need to emphasize that more as archaeologists. We need to ask the descendant groups of the people that we're studying what they think about what we're doing with the artifacts once we excavate them. We need to talk to them about their interpretation of the artifacts and the sites and the features and the things that we're finding. We need to talk to them about those things, because while we like to see ourselves as experts, we're not necessarily. I understand the importance of things like experimental archaeology, but in some ways, just the fundamental, some fundamental parts of things like experimental archaeology really bother me. I remember as an undergrad, and even as teaching some undergrad classes, where you'll have students say things like, how did the Pawnee butcher a buffalo, you know, that quickly with these stone tools without it going bad or blah, blah, blah. How did they do it? So let's replicate it. I'm like, go ask them. They're still here. And I think that's a big part of decolonizing archaeology. Archaeology, just by nature, puts people in the past. We're not in the past. We're still here. We're a resource to be talked to. So to be ignored like that and to be pushed into the past and to only be displayed as people in the past, that's perpetuating the colonialism that is so inherent in the beginnings of archaeology and anthropology, that Indians were going away. So we had to preserve everything we could about them because they're disappearing. They're going away. So certain aspects of archaeology, ask. You know, we're still here. We didn't go away completely. We still have knowledge of what we're doing. There's people even now that I deal with nearly on a daily basis trying to interpret things in the city from a non-Indigenous perspective. And we've emphasized over and over the tribes disavow that, but they consider themselves experts on it and they don't want to listen to the tribes. And it's extremely frustrating. And I think it's racist in a lot of ways. And it's very imperialistic to have this idea that we're going to interpret your past for you and you hush. We're going to tell you, we're going to tell you how it was. We're the experts in this field. And it's very damaging.
Yeah, that is, I think, a very important point, that if we are really going to decolonize anthropology and improve land management and heritage and all of these fields, we need to actually consider Indigenous knowledge on the same level as archaeological, etc. knowledge.
Very much so. I mean, an example of that is the recent article that came out about the genetic study in Chaco Canyon. On the human remains that they did there. Where was the tribal consultation with that? And they're calling them unaffiliated human remains. We know who Chaco Canyon descendants are. We have known. Not only have Native people known, but archaeologists and anthropologists have known that for decades. It's not, it's not up for grabs. So I don't understand how something like that can, how researchers can ethically go about and say, well, we didn't know what group they belong to, so we decided to just go ahead with it without permission.
Yeah.
These are people. They're not artifacts. Those are human beings with descendants, with living descendants that work is impacting. So to me, that's just mind-boggling that is still happening today. As far as we've come, we still have things like that happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're going to need to take our next break, but I guess while we're on this break, one thing that's come up for me a lot lately is exactly what you're talking about how do we make it unacceptable within the field to do this kind of behavior? How do we still have people presenting at conferences and these kinds of articles when it is so clearly against the ethics of the field? So one thing to just think about while we're on break is, what do we do? How do we approach this in a tangible way to make some real change? Mm-hmm. So on that note, we will be back.
Kim Bidulf explores the books set in our prehistoric past on Prehistories, an innovative and creative show. Kim investigates the archaeology and anthropology behind your favorite stories by bringing on guests that are experts in the field and that can speak to the actual story behind the story. Check out the show at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/prehistories. Now let's get back to the show.
All right, we are back. So I brought up this question right before we went to break about what can we do? You know, obviously these types of discussions have been happening in anthropology for, at this point, decades.
Mm-hmm.
And this is still clearly an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So from your perspective, are there things that we can do in order to really move this along?
Oh, I definitely think there are. I think we have a long way to go in decolonizing archaeology. And I think it takes a very conscious effort by, in particular, non-native archaeologists. What I try to do a lot of the times when I teach a field tour or when I talk to college classes and things like that, I always emphasize that impact on living people. I think that students oftentimes aren't given that perspective, and we don't talk about that in a lot of university courses. We might talk about that more in like the cultural anthropology side of it, but not so much with the archaeology. And I think that's extremely important. It kind of boggles my mind that we're not talking about it more. It does very much impact living people. What you say, how you interpret someone's past, or whether you involve them or not in the interpretation of their past, has a very real lasting impact on that group. And I think that's something that I try to introduce to students right away. Every time I've taught a field school, I've made every effort to have some sort of tribal leader or someone come out to the field school that I'm teaching, because I think that presence has a very lasting impact on the minds of those students to say,
mm-hmm.
It's not even just me. There's more people. Indians are still here, and we're still being impacted by these things. So you need to consider that with every step of your career and everything that you're doing. I think a lot of times it's overlooked the colonial roots of anthropology also. I think there should be at least one class devoted to talking about that. In every single intro to archaeology class taught in university, we need to talk about how colonistic archaeology can be, the roots of it, and how we can change that. I like to bring up Ishii as an example of that, or talk about Thomas Jefferson excavating, who is considered the father of American archaeology, excavating burial mounds. While he knew that people were still coming and putting offerings at the burial mounds and things like that. So he knew they were actively being used and visited. And still, it's very humanizing to think that he decided, sure, I'm just going to excavate it anyway.
Right.
And I think it's important to point those kinds of things out to students and talk about what a terrible thing that would be for somebody to go dig up a cemetery right now. But that's how archaeology started in the Americas in particular. So I think that's another important point to make to students. And I think in general, archaeologists outside the classroom, I think, again, that emphasis on being cultural anthropologists or just anthropologists before we're archaeologists, understanding the two different worldviews, trying to step out of that Western scientific box to look at it from other perspectives. And I think we need more consultation, like I said before, not only when it's required. I try to contact the tribes anytime that we're doing a new project around here in Colorado Springs. I try to contact our local tribes to tell them what we're doing, just to give them a heads up. A lot of times I can't give them a whole lot of information until we've actually excavated or surveyed or collected artifacts. Mm-hmm. And then we bring them in. I know a lot of archaeologists have a hard time with this idea, but we need to ask them what they would like us to do with the artifacts as well, which I know can get sticky, like NAGPRA issues and things like that, with who has control of the artifacts and things like that.
Right.
But sometimes we need to repatriate artifacts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need to repatriate whole collections. They're, like I said, as archaeologists, they're not ours. And so for them to be sitting on a shelf, I know that that rubs a lot of archaeologists and curators and people the wrong way. But again, it's that stepping out of that Western kind of scientific mindset and that idea that they belong to us as archaeologists. And then lastly, I would say, I think it's very important that archaeologists don't just talk about Native people in past tense.
Mm-hmm.
That is very impactful on Indian people. Just go to an elementary school. What did you learn in elementary school? You learned about Indians in the past. When you talk, you know, when Thanksgiving comes around, that's when we talk about Indians. But, or maybe if we have, you know, archaeologists come in and talk about it, we're still talking about Native people in the past.
Right.
So when I put together teaching kits and things like that for my job, or when I go to schools and things like that, I always emphasize to the people that are going to be using the kits, don't just talk about us in the past. We're still here. Mm-hmm. And I always want to work in ways to talk about how this is impacting living people, or to talk about the tribal consultation that was done on these sites that we're talking about, and things like that. I think there, we have a long way to go in decolonizing archaeology, and archaeologists are the ones that need to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I like the fact that you gave some really tangible suggestions and things that people can do there. And in addition to, obviously, the larger goals and things like that.
Right.
One thing that you touched on, and I'm curious to hear more about your experience, is so when you were, I believe, an undergrad, it was in your CV, that you did a summer research institute at the University of Arizona, and you were looking at vandalism and NAGPRA and Arizona state law.
Right.
And all of that you were just talking about reminded me of that in your CV, and just being curious about what that experience was like for you and how this might have shaped some of what you're talking about.
Let's see. I was working at the time, you know, again, I was pretty young. I think I was 21 at the time. I had taken two field schools by that time, had a pretty good idea of where I wanted to go with my career. And I definitely wanted that emphasis. I wanted to get more familiar with the laws, state laws and federal laws regarding repatriation and things like that, and tribal consultation. So I got this opportunity to go down to University of Arizona in Tucson, and I worked with John Madsen, who at the time was the Arizona State Repatriation Coordinator, and we had to pick a project, and he had started talking about different terrible, awful cases that he'd been involved with, where people were buying and selling human remains, and kind of the laws that Arizona has surrounding those that really have very little teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Where I remember some of the examples where people would come in and just loot a site, and they'd get all these whole pots and things like that, and they'd sell them for, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, and then they'd get a $2,000 fine. So it was totally worth it for them to keep looting. So I guess I just got interested in that, and we were talking about different kinds of, I guess, the intricacies of how NAGPRA worked in Arizona at the time, particularly down in Tucson and things like that. Thankfully, I have never had to deal with human remains myself. It's not something that I'd want to do. I think I'd have to defer to another archaeologist if that were to... Oh, I know that that's what would happen if that were to occur. But I did get to talk to several tribal representatives at the time about kind of how it works and how it's negotiated and things like that. So it was a good learning experience just to become familiar with the laws. And I think a lot of it was their shortcomings too. So it was a good experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's an interesting point that you bring in too about, I think a lot of times people don't realize how much we're asking of Indigenous people with things like ARPA and NAGPRA, and like you, for example, talking about having to step away if there was to be a situation with human remains, that it's, we're asking an awful lot of people in a way that doesn't make sense culturally, because culturally, you know, traditionally there was never these kinds of circumstances. You know, one tribe, for example, talking to me about the fact that they don't have a repatriation ceremony because there was never a reason to have to rebury people because people didn't get unburied before. And that you can't just culturally make up a ceremony. So I guess I just wanted to highlight for any non-Indigenous people that are listening that not only are you not just doing them a favor, quote unquote, by bringing them into consultation, but like you already mentioned, you're learning from their knowledge and you're asking an awful lot of people. You're asking them to do things that can be very painful. So just for people to be mindful of that.
Yes, very, very mindful. A lot of times it's very emotionally, I mean, it's emotional for me, so I can't imagine being the person that actually has to make the decisions and has to negotiate with fellow tribes and things like that. It's heavy. It's heavy to even think about. It's heavy when it's not even human remains. Sometimes those artifacts aren't just inanimate objects. So when it comes to human remains, it's even more amplified. So it's a heavy thing that you're asking people to participate in. It's not generally pleasant or fun. I think that us as archaeologists would need to be extremely mindful of every way that archaeology impacts living people.
So, for example, you're talking about how not just human remains, but artifacts, what they can mean to people. And for me, for example, I'm Jewish, and during World War II, Hitler was creating a museum to the dead race, where he took items from Jewish homes and synagogues throughout the land that he had occupied, and was creating, you know, this museum to the dead race, which obviously has echoes in American and Indian history, you know, massacres, and then creating a museum of the dead people's race. And for me, growing up, we had one of the Torahs, which is the Old Testament, its own lambskin, that was taken from this museum and given back to our community. And having this Torah and having it when out at a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah or coming of age ceremony, or having it, you know, at our new year, it really, like, how much that means to us. As, you know, this is a symbol of the fact that we are not dead.
Mm-hmm.
You did not kill us off, and we will persevere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that people quite understand how much these artifacts can mean to people.
Right.
And mean to their communities.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, that's the importance, I think, of archaeologists being anthropologists first, is looking at the bigger picture, not just focusing on the science and what we can garner from this information. What can we learn from it by keeping it and studying it, and in a lot of ways, dehumanizing the people that we're studying and their descendants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what
right.
can
we're
it's
continuing
not, it's about? It's looking at the bigger picture of the past that has occurred mm-hmm. for these descendants, and how our position as archaeologists, and especially for non-Native people, that position of being non-Indigenous and studying a past that is not your own, that has, in a lot of ways, a very sad, terrible, difficult past.
Mm-hmm.
So to not recognize that as archaeologists is, I think you're a terrible anthropologist if you're not
right.
looking at all those facets, and you're even as a scientist. A little off track here too, but with archaeology and with it being a science, I always kind of equate it to someone coming in and wanting to build a dam or reroute a stream without consulting the hydrologist and a biologist and a botanist and people like that. We as archaeologists coming into a place and just trying to interpret something just from one source, I think is ridiculous, and it's bad science to not go in and talk to really the experts on this. They're the experts.
Right.
These descendant communities are the experts on these paths. I think it's just bad science and bad practice to not be emphasizing that in our research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the need to, as well, to constantly be evaluating yourself and constantly
mm-hmm.
be aware of what you're in it for. Are you actually doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And am I, in this situation, am I being respectful? In this situation, am I being a good advocate, a good ally?
Right.
In this situation, am I doing what needs to be done? It's not just a one-time decision
mm-hmm.
or, okay, now I'm decolonized.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's a continual fact of life throughout.
Right. And I think even as an Indigenous archaeologist, I am trained in a Western way. I went to Western scientific perspective in my schooling and things like that. So it's not only non-Native archaeologists who need to always be thinking about those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. We are basically at the end, but I do want to make sure that we get to one last thing, because it's one of the, I think, really interesting things about your work.
Okay.
For a lot of people, is that people know about archaeologists on a federal level. They know about archaeologists on a state level. But being an archaeologist for a city
mm-hmm.
and doing tribal consultation on behalf of a city or a university, which you did as well,
mm-hmm.
is kind of a new concept for people. So I would feel amiss not asking about it, at least, since I know that for a lot of people, I'm sure that's what they've been waiting to hear about. So can you talk a little bit about what it's like being an archaeologist for a city, as well as doing tribal consultation at the city and university level?
Okay. Let's see, I'll talk more about the city. I should have mentioned this earlier, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want to throw in that.
Yeah, I should have mentioned this earlier, too, that while I am the lead archaeologist for the city of Colorado Springs, I'm not necessarily speaking for the city in this in this podcast here. But as far as my duties with the city, I think I've kind of looked into it to see how many city archaeologists we have in the nation, and I haven't found a whole lot. I know that in Colorado we have one more, and that's in Boulder. But most of the city archaeologists that I've seen are in places like Boston or St. Augustine, Florida, where there's been a long Euro-American occupation, and that's more what they're, I think, looking at and protecting and mitigating are more like colonial sites and things like that. Whereas I know Albuquerque also has a city archaeologist now, and I think what we're doing here for the most part, and in a lot of the Western cities that have an archaeologist, we're focusing on our open space properties. The city of Colorado Springs has 37 trails and open space properties with almost 5,000 acres in trails and open space. So a big part of my job, and I was only hired a year ago, and I am the first and only archaeologist for the city. So I'm kind of making it up as I go. But probably the biggest goal of my position is to figure out what kind of archaeological resources we have on our properties. Right now, I pretty much only focus on the open space properties. So I'm just trying to figure out, get a handle on what we have, see what's already been surveyed, what hasn't, what we need to look at. And then it's also to not only kind of compile a database of that and figure out what we have so that we can mitigate it. Really, the goal is to be good stewards of it, to be protecting it. Our emphasis isn't so much, I guess, on research of it. We don't really have the funding for that kind of thing. So we're not doing a whole lot of excavation or things like that unless it's required by certain projects. But it's more to get a handle on what we've got and see how we can protect it. So another part of that protection of it is to educate our park rangers and people that are working outside a lot and how to recognize archaeological sites, so that when the landscape architects and people like that go out there to put new trails in and things like that, we're not plowing right through an archaeological site. And then also, once we get things actually really fully recorded, which is going to take a long time with one lonely archaeologist, it's going to be to document it so that, you know, for future reference, we're not hurting these sites or doing any damage to them. Let's see, what else?
And then it was the tribal consultation.
Yeah, so with the tribal consultation, that's been a little bit tricky. Fortunately, I think City of Colorado Springs has a pretty good history of doing tribal consultation when it's not necessarily required. Actually, one of the reasons that I was looked at for this position was I was involved in some of the, so the city was doing one specific project where they had just asked the local native community, so not an official tribal consultation, because they weren't asking at that time yet, weren't asking official tribal representatives, which we definitely emphasize doing now. But they were asking the local native community what we thought about this one project, and I showed up to a meeting and then kind of caught the eye of my now boss, and here I am. But so that's just an example of this idea that the city of Colorado Springs, in some ways, where they can, at least the parks and rec, have a pretty good history of trying to do that, trying to do tribal consultation when and where we can. A lot of the tribal consultation that I do is kind of checking up on a lot of our federal agencies. We get quite a few grants and things like that through different federal agencies. And of course, when the federal agencies are involved, that triggers Section 106, which means that I kind of go through and make sure that that's done. I'm sure you'd be unsurprised to know how often that falls through the cracks. So
yeah,
I've caught a few instances of that already in the last year that I've been here. And then I've actually kind of taken over and done some of the consultation myself. But more what I'm also focusing on is on any of our properties. If we're going to do a major survey or any sort of excavation or anything like that, even when it's not necessarily required, I go out and I talk to our designated state tribes to talk to them about what's going on and how they feel about it and things like that. So it's been interesting. Part of when I do consultation, I always feel like, since they're doing you a favor, I think a lot of the reason some archaeologists don't get responses from tribes is because not only are you asking them to do your favor, but you're also asking them to come from wherever they are to your place, and you're not offering them any assistance. So I generally, it's been my practice to not ask. I mean, I'll do like phone consultation, things like that. But if I really have an important site and things like that that I want them to come to,
right,
I make sure that I have the funding to pay for a hotel and mileage and things like that first.
I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, I mean, it is. So, and I know that that's part of the problem with why we probably don't do more tribal consultation, which is unfortunate, but it's luckily the city here has helped with some of those things. So, for example, through the university in 2015, I helped lead an excavation here in Garden of the Gods, which is obviously a highly sacred space to a lot of groups. So we let them know that we were going to excavate beforehand. They were okay with it, so we went ahead. And then after we excavated, and it was only a city-funded project, so we weren't required by the state or the feds to do it, but we brought them down here. And I think my point mainly is to emphasize the fact that it's not ours to deal with by ourselves. I think it's only right that we involve the tribes in these kinds of projects and plans and things like that. So that's been one of my main goals, and thankfully my bosses and people like that agree with me and have allowed me to do that. So it's been a good experience thus far.
Good. So are there any resources or suggestions you would have for people wanting to learn more about the types of things that you were talking about here today?
Well, I guess in general, I think it would benefit all archaeologists and non-archaeologists, even people just who are interested in the past. There are quite a few books now. When I was an undergrad, I really struggled to find information about kind of indigenous perspectives on archaeology. There are quite a few books now out there talking about just that or talking about issues with NAGPRA. There are many books out there now written by indigenous archaeologists. Just doing a Google search or an Amazon search about indigenous archaeology has been really helpful. So that's one of the things that I've looked at. I definitely still need to read up some more, but I think another good source is to go and visit tribal museums and things like that. The Southern Ute now have their museum that just opened, I think, what was it, last month? Through History Colorado funding and things like that, too.
The one in Montrose or the one at Southern Ute?
I think, the one in Montrose, right, is the new one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They opened just last month.
But I think any indigenous-led museums and things like that, I think, will give you a different perspective.
Right.
Than the non-indigenous one, so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle.
And edited by Richie Cruz.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.